Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are looking at a digital battlefield, one that's escalating faster than almost any other in the world. We're diving into a stack of intelligence from Taiwan's National Security Bureau, the NSB, that documented a really alarming trend in 2025. And what they found was that state-sponsored cyber attacks targeting Taiwan's energy sector. Well, they didn't just increase, they skyrocketed by a colossal 1,000% compared to the year before. This isn't just a statistical bump. It signals a fundamental shift, you know, away from routine cyber espionage and toward what looks like deliberate pre-positioning for a crisis. So our mission today is to unpack the strategy behind this huge surge, to understand the sophisticated methods being used, and really to look at what this campaign means for critical infrastructure defense everywhere. Because the lessons from this, they're relevant to every power grid, every hospital all over the world.
Exactly. And that 1,000% figure, it grabs your attention. But the really crucial thing to focus on here is the intent. When a nation state specifically targets power generation, petroleum distribution, natural gas infrastructure, it reveals a goal that goes way beyond just gathering intelligence. This isn't about stealing data. It's about gaining the ability to manipulate physical processes, you know, to cause disruption that could cripple an economy, cripple daily life. This campaign really is an essential global case study for how modern cyber warfare is actually fought.
And the numbers really do underscore that strategic focus you're talking about. While the overall number of cyber incidents that were linked to Chinese actors only went up by, what, a modest 6% in 2025, that attention was completely disproportionate.
Completely.
The energy sector just took the absolute brunt of it, right? That massive tenfold increase.
It did. But it's interesting to see where else they put their resources.
Right, because it wasn't exclusively energy. You pointed out that they didn't just abandon other critical targets. So which other sectors saw that sort of concerning level of activity? What does that tell us about their goals?
That's a key point. Energy was absolutely the primary target, but humanitarian infrastructure was next in line. Emergency rescue services, hospitals, they saw a really significant 54% jump in attacks.
54%? Wow.
Yeah. And communications networks also saw a 6.7% uptick. The fact that they targeted humanitarian services suggests a dual goal. On one hand, it's about disruption, but on the other, it's probably psychological.
Psychological how?
Well, you're trying to degrade the public's confidence in the government's ability to respond in a crisis. And what's also interesting is which sectors they ignored. Finance and water resources actually saw less activity.
So they weren't just spreading their resources thin?
Not at all. They were being strategically allocated, put right on the targets that offer the biggest advantage if you're pre-positioning for a conflict.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, the coordination is, frankly, chilling. The NSB noted these distinct spikes in malicious activity that lined up perfectly with major political events. Things like policy announcements, overseas diplomatic visits.
And that timing is absolutely crucial to analyze. It shows sophisticated planning. It shows, really, a strong strategic intent coming from a central authority. These cyber operations are clearly not isolated incidents. They're integrated parts of a much broader strategy.
Statecraft, essentially.
Exactly. They're being used for reconnaissance, for testing defenses, and sometimes just to send a political message by flexing their muscles right when diplomatic tensions are high. It says, we see you and we can interfere.
Which brings us to the methodology. How are they actually getting in? How are they achieving this access at such a massive scale?
The report confirms that they're intensely probing industrial control systems, or ICS.
The heart of the infrastructure.
The absolute heart. These are the systems that manage the physical processes, turning valves on and off, controlling generators, regulating gas distribution.
Okay, I want to jump in on that. For our listeners, can you quickly explain why ICS are such a weak spot? Is it just a technology problem?
It absolutely is. I mean, many of these systems were put in place decades ago, long before anyone was even thinking about modern cyber threats. Their whole design philosophy is about availability and reliability. You know, the power has to stay on.
Right. Security was an afterthought.
Or not a thought at all.
Right.
So they're running on legacy systems you can't easily patch. They often lack modern monitoring. It makes them inherently vulnerable to a determined attacker.
And this is where the NSB found a particularly concerning tactic, one that shows just how well the attackers understand their targets. They're exploiting planned software upgrades at these energy facilities.
This is truly next level stuff. Think about it. During a planned maintenance window, the security teams are focused on the upgrade. The systems are temporarily in a state of flux.
So the network's defenses are at their weakest point.
Precisely. And that's the moment the hackers try to infect the operational technology, the OT settings, the actual machinery controls with malware. They get in while the security sensors are temporarily disabled for the upgrade.
And the intelligence they must get from that kind of pre-positioned malware, it must be immense.
It is. And it's not just about turning the lights off tomorrow. The malware can just sit there, dormant, providing ongoing visibility into operational planning.
So they can see maintenance schedules, material procurement.
Exactly where they've set up backup systems.
Yeah.
This kind of real-time insight would be invaluable in a real conflict. It lets an adversary know exactly where the choke points are for maximum impact.
But they're not just relying on one trick, are they? The NSB identified a whole diversified arsenal. Can you walk us through the main attack vectors?
Absolutely. The first and the most common method was the continuous exploitation of known hardware and software vulnerabilities, just constantly scanning for unpatched systems.
The basics, but at a massive scale.
Right, and trying to use 0 days to get that first foothold.
Okay, that's the persistent threat. But what about when they want immediate disruption or, say, to create a diversion?
That's where you see the distributed denial of service attacks, DDoS. Sometimes they're used just to knock a service offline. But more often, they're a diversionary tactic.
How so?
You flood the security team with alerts from a DDoS attack over here, pulling all their attention, while you're actually tenting a much stealthier intrusion over there.
And despite all the high-tech malware, we always come back to the weakest link.
The human element, precisely. The third vector is social engineering, phishing, manipulation. It just proves that human vulnerabilities are often just as, if not more, exploitable than technical ones.
And these aren't just generic spam emails.
Not at all. Highly personalized, well-researched lures designed to trick a specific employee into giving up their credentials.
And finally, the one that I think worries security professionals everywhere, supply chain compromises.
Yes. This is perhaps the most insidious. Sophisticated actors infiltrate a trusted vendor, a service provider, and then they use that relationship, like a legitimate software update, as a backdoor into a hardened target.
So if you can't trust your supply chain.
Then you can bypass even the strongest perimeter defenses.
So while energy was the top priority, this campaign was putting pressure on the whole ecosystem with different tactics for different targets.
That's right. In the communication sector, for instance, the focus was on long-term persistent access. We saw adversary-in-the-middle attacks designed to intercept or redirect data.
Just to watch and listen over time.
Exactly, to surveil critical communications.
And for government agencies, it sounds like it was less about physical disruption and more about pure espionage.
Pure espionage. Relentless phishing campaigns aim squarely at stealing sensitive or classified materials. As the NSB noted, these were highly personalized social engineering attempts. They did their homework.
Now, the tech sector, which is home to some world-leading semiconductor companies, was targeted for intellectual property theft. Does that suggest a secondary goal beyond military prep? Is this also about economic leverage?
It's both. The NSB saw specific targeting of advanced chip designs, manufacturing processes, things like that. Gaining that IP doesn't just help your own military hardware development down the line, it also provides an immense economic benefit. You're basically getting billions of dollars of R&D for free.
The complexity of this whole operation,
Yeah.
it suggests it's not just one team. It requires specialized groups.
Yeah.
The NSB attributed the campaign to several well-known Chinese Advanced Persistent Threat Groups, or APTs.
Right. And for anyone listening, an APT is a highly skilled, typically state-sponsored group. Their whole goal is to maintain access to a network for a long time without being detected. They don't smash and grab, they're patient.
So who are the major players here?
The NSB identified five key groups, and each one seems to have a specialized role.
Okay, walk us through them.
First, you have Black Tech. They're known for router compromise and using legitimate system tools to hide, what we call living off the land techniques.
Hiding in plain sight.
Exactly. Then there's Flax Typhoon. Their focus is maintaining that long-term access, methodically mapping out a network, preparing it for some future operation. They're like digital spies hiding in the walls.
And what about the ones focused on political targets?
That would be Mustang Panda. They traditionally go after government and political entities with those sophisticated spear phishing campaigns we talked about.
Okay.
Then you've got APT-41, which is unique because it has this dual mission. State-directed espionage and financially motivated cybercrime. Their interest in supply chain attacks is a big part of this campaign.
And finally, you said there was a fifth, the highest level threat.
That would be UNC-3886. The NSB describes them as one of the most sophisticated threats out there. They have the capability to use zero-day vulnerabilities, the ones nobody knows about yet, and they're experts at evading security tools. The sheer number of these specialized groups, plus the coordination with real-world events, it all points to direction from a central authority. It multiplies their effectiveness way beyond what any single group could do.
So what does all this mean for the global cybersecurity landscape? I mean, the situation in Taiwan clearly has implications that go way beyond this one specific conflict.
Critically, it reflects a broader global trend. That huge jump in energy sector targeting signals that nation-states are now actively pre-positioning what are basically cyber weapons inside critical infrastructure all over the world.
They're creating capabilities that could just be activated during a future crisis.
To cause disruption, to coerce political decisions.
Absolutely.
It really reinforces this idea of integrated warfare. The clear link between a DDoS attack and, say, a diplomatic visit shows that the digital and physical worlds are now completely merged in modern statecraft. They are. And that relentless focus on supply chain compromises, that's the global risk we all have to face now. When a trusted vendor becomes an attack vector, even organizations with the best defenses are still vulnerable.
It forces you to scrutinize every single part of your supply chain.
Every single part. But Taiwan's response offers some really crucial, actionable lessons. They recognize that these threats cross borders, so the NSB is actively cooperating with more than 30 countries.
And that collaboration is vital.
It's everything. It allows for rapid intelligence sharing, indicators of compromise, so other teams can proactively hunt for the same activity on their own networks. It also helps with joint investigations to disrupt the attacker's infrastructure.
Domestically, they're also strengthening their defenses. I saw they have mandatory incident reporting now and information sharing platforms for the private sector.
Yes, and they're enhancing security standards specifically for those vulnerable industrial control systems we discussed. It's a multi-pronged approach.
Which is really the only way to tackle this. But we do need to acknowledge just how hard this is for the people on the ground, the security operators.
We do. These are incredibly complex environments: energy, water, healthcare. They were fundamentally designed for availability, for efficiency, not for resilience against a state-sponsored adversary.
And it's not just about old equipment, is it?
No. Their OT environments are this mix of legacy systems that are hard to patch and network architectures that just weren't designed for this. And there's an inherent trade-off. If you prioritize security too heavily, you might risk causing an outage yourself.
So the pressure to just keep the lights on means security gaps can persist for a long time.
For a very long time, which is why an effective defense has to be a multi-layered, holistic approach. It's not just about buying a better firewall.
What are those layers?
First, you need strong technical controls. Network segmentation, so a breach in one area can't spread, continuous monitoring deep inside the OT systems, and rapid patch management where you can.
Second, you need robust organizational measures.
Right. That means having a comprehensive incident response plan ready to go. And just as important, regular security drills and simulations. You have to test your defenses under stress.
Simulate what a black tech attack actually looks like.
So you know how your teams will react. And then critically, that third piece, the human element.
Always the human element.
It requires constant training to recognize those sophisticated social engineering attempts. The best security system in the world can be bypassed by one tired employee clicking one clever link. A culture of vigilance is essential. Ultimately, though, resilience planning has to start with one assumption: breaches will happen, despite your best efforts. So that means you must have backup systems, you must have redundant capabilities, and you must have detailed recovery procedures to keep critical services running, even when the primary systems are down. That shift in mindset from pure prevention to resilience first is absolutely essential.
So, to summarize this deep dive, Taiwan's energy sector faced an unprecedented 1,000% surge in state-sponsored attacks in 2025. This wasn't random. It was a highly targeted campaign, integrated with political timing and carried out by sophisticated APT groups focused on gaining long-term access to vulnerable industrial control systems. The global lessons are clear. Your supply chain is your new perimeter, and the integration of digital and physical domains is the new reality of conflict.
And here is a final thought for you to consider. Given the overwhelming evidence that adversaries are pre-positioning dormant capabilities within critical infrastructure globally, what is the true hidden cost-economic, operational, social flagellation of focusing our defensive resources almost solely on preventing the initial breach instead of investing just as much in redundancy and the ability to rapidly recover? That balance between prevention and resilience, that's the defining challenge of our digital age.